the successful tech companies that we've worked with have that embedded in their culture. So a lawyer isn't just there to help you get rid of a problem. The lawyer is there as a growth enabler.
Welcome to The Wired Wick, demystifying tech law trends and educating about law in tomorrow's society. Hello and welcome back to The Wired Wick. My name is Annabelle Pemberton, and in this week's episode, I spoke to Electra Yapona, who is the founder of The Law Boutique, a legal operations consultancy firm that can really help you with legal design, legal operations, contract management, and data protection. In this week's episode, Electra and I spoke about how she really went about founding The Law Boutique and what problems she came across in the legal industry to spur her on to do so. We also talk about legal design and why it's so important to consider when you're drafting documents for different clients and overall in all your legal operations. And finally, there's also some tips and advice in here about how to work better with your legal team, whether you're engaging them externally or whether you're working with them internally. Enjoy the episode.
So thank you for joining me today on The Wired Wick, Electra. I'm really excited for our conversation today and looking at design thinking and its influence in the legal world. So firstly, what was the reason you mainly worked in counsel prior to founding The Law Boutique?
Thank you for having me. So the reason I founded The Law Boutique was the fact that I'd spent 10 years in-house. And I was never a traditional lawyer in a legal capacity. I was more a commercial manager or a contract manager or a legal manager. So I sat very much between legal and the business. And I was always very frustrated with the way that things worked. So I suppose when I first joined as a lawyer, when I first decided to go in-house as a lawyer, I always really wanted to be part of a business. I never wanted to sit and advise at arm's length. So I always wanted to be very involved. But then when I went in-house, I saw that actually the involvement was rather limited if you were an in-house lawyer to an extent. So that's why I decided to start The Law Boutique, because I thought there needs to be a better way to deliver law, but in a more commercial way.
Okay. And was there a particular instance where you thought, okay, there's a problem here and maybe I could do something to solve it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so I started my career in the space industry. So I started off working for the European Space Agency in Holland. And obviously when you're working for the European Space Agency, you're not the star of the show as the lawyer, the rocket scientists are. So I had to adapt my ways of working, and I really had to, you know, you think your contract is the most important thing in the world. It's not, but the rocket is, or the satellite is. So I had to, I was trained in an environment where I think it was really evident to me that I was there to support the main function, which, you know, in that instance, really clever people that have very, very specific requirements. So I would always tailor what I needed to make sure that they would engage with that. So then when I moved from the European Space Agency to Airbus, I took that with me, and that was an environment where that also was expected. And then I went into more commercial roles. So I worked for British American Tobacco and then Disney for a while. Mm-hmm. And in those types of organizations where they were more commercial, I found that there was a bit of a silo when it came to the legal team. So the legal team would only be called upon when things went wrong, or if someone in the business wanted them to take a risk, or, you know, who signs this? Can you review this agreement? Instead of saying, right, we're going to engage in this new commercial opportunity, come and partner with us from the outset, because we need to understand the legal risks. We need someone who's really going to be involved. Legal were just there to be called upon. And so when I was in these organizations in my future roles, I found that shouldn't be the way, because that's why these business teams aren't getting the most out of their legal team. So I tried to bridge the gap a little bit. But the incident that made me feel that my calling is what we do now at The Law Boutique was in my last role, I spent 4 months negotiating a huge IT contract, multi-million pound IT contract. And during those four months, I spent most of my time negotiating with our own in-house lawyers and with the external counsel that was supporting us, basically saying, guys, the way that we're drafting this contract is just completely non-conducive to a fruitful outcome, because the stuff that you've written in this contract will not be understood by the engineers that need to deliver it, or the technology teams that need to ensure that the governance is in place to make sure that it happens in the way that you want it to. So this language is not conducive to the outcome that you want. So after the 4 months finished and we signed the contract, I spent another 4 months redrafting the whole agreement because people did not understand it. And it was unclear and there were grey areas. And I also helped to build some tech to facilitate the changes to the contracts that happen quite a lot in an IT environment. And I did lots of training and I revised the agreement so that it would be simpler language, infographics, stuff like that. And I thought, this has added so much value, probably more value than a watertight agreement. I know people will slate me for saying that, but it's true, because I think when lawyers draft, this is not lawyer bashing, but sometimes when lawyers draft, they do forget who the end user is. So they think that the end user is the judge. I think when lawyers draft, this is not lawyer bashing, but sometimes when lawyers draft, they do forget who the end user is. So they think that the end user is the judge. Support the project that you're drafting the agreement for. Otherwise, it's not a multifaceted document. It's just a document, it's an insurance policy in case things go wrong. It's not a facilitative document, which is what I think we should be considering when we're drafting very expensive documents. It shouldn't just be an expensive insurance policy. It should be something that allows the parties to understand what behaviors they need to be adopting and what the requirements are, what the expectations are.
Yes, and it forms part and parcel of the product as a whole. Yes, I was really inspired by your privacy policy on the Law Boutique website. I really like that, because I feel those sort of documents as well, everyone's so used to and being very wordy and filled with legalese, and it's for the people at the end of the day, and they need to be written in a way that everyone can understand. And there's also, I feel at least there's also opportunities in making sure that legal documents are drafted in the right way, because you're building that relationship between yourself and your client. And it's really important. So that's great. So I suppose this moves nicely a bit into legal design in that way. So could you briefly explain what is legal design?
Sure. So legal design is effectively taking a very user-centric approach, which also sounds like jargon, but it's effectively keeping the end user of whatever it is that you're creating in mind. And that goes for legal documents like contracts, privacy policies, general compliance documents and policies, but also processes. So if you look at the process of, for example, having someone give you a contract to review, if you're an in-house lawyer, then how do you make that process as easy as possible for that person who's giving you that document? Instead of thinking of yourself and your own requirements as a lawyer, which are important, you need to make sure that your customer, your internal customer, is also, their needs are met when you're creating that process. So legal design is taking a human-centric approach to the creation of your documents, your processes, or your products, whereby you put the user's needs first.
That's fantastic. And do you have like a specific situation when you noticed the user's needs were not placed in the center, or where you can see now today where it's still a problem and you'd really like to tackle it in that way?
Yeah, so lots of our business comes from other businesses that basically say, look, we got our T's and C's drafted by a really big law firm, and obviously they're watertight, but no one understands them. So we send this document out to the other side, because we specialize in tech scale-ups and young organizations, very fast growth, fast-paced. So deal speed is very important to them, and it's also a huge commercial advantage, and conversely, a huge disadvantage if that process is very slow, the contracting process. because you want to sell your product, right? You want to sell it quick. And that's not supported if you've got a really heavy legal document that goes to the other side, and then the other side picks it up and thinks, oh my God, what does this even say? Some of these other organizations that are buying the product or the service don't have an in-house lawyer. So when they see a super confusing document, they obviously need to send that off to an external law firm, or if they have lawyers, engage them, which is the right thing to do. When they engage the lawyers in whatever capacity, they'll look at that document and they'll think, right, well, this is really, really heavy, lots of legalese. I need to spend a long time reviewing it so I can understand what it says. And I'm obviously going to mark it up loads as well, because it's in this really non-transparent language. And as soon as you pick up a document like that, psychologically, lawyer or not, you're on the back foot, because all you're doing is looking at whether there are any loopholes or traps that you mustn't fall into. So if you think about this just from a very human aspect, you pick up a contract that's written in horrible language. You know, my worst is when they do two columns on one page, like, as if any human eye reads like that. It's deliberate to make you not read it. Anyway, so you pick it up, you look at it, and you think, oh my God, I really don't want to review this document. Mm-hmm. You're on the back foot, you're thinking negatively, and you're thinking, they're trying to pull one over on me now, so I need to be really, really over-vigilant, and I'm going to pick up all the stuff that I think is a little bit dodgy. And then you'll send that document back, and then you'll start this negotiation, and you're going back on stuff, back and forth on stuff that, you know, you're both going to agree to at some point, otherwise the business can't go forward. Mm-hmm. So you end up falling back into a position that you are happy with in principle. But why don't you do that from the outset? So lots of our business comes from these customers that have these documents that are legally correct, but operationally a nightmare and cause delays. And we will revamp the whole set of T's and C's. It's a very difficult job, because you need to make sure that it's written in plain English, that it carries the tone of voice of the organization that you're drafting for, because it should be consistent at the end of the day. Yes. People forget that their legal documents are part of their branding. So we actually work with copywriters if they're in an organization to make sure that we really get the tone of voice. And we also work with their design teams and if it's something that's going online, we work with their developers as well. So it's a team effort to create a product that's fit for purpose. And we see it all the time, even with young organizations. We see some documents and we're like, this stuff just does not reflect your really cool brand. Let us help you.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I've seen this just with some startups as well, that they have very lengthy legal documents as if they've taken the privacy policy from a template somewhere. And there's aspects there that don't even need to be there, but I suppose they don't have the funds or the resources to invest in legal aid, and they just want to make sure they're covered, and they're just hoping that the template will cover it all. But it's a shame, because overall they're losing the tone of voice that is just running so consistently through their website and their service. So,
and it's not just that. I mean, especially in consumer-facing businesses, it's very important that your terms are clear and transparent, because if they're not, you're just going to get loads of questions from customers. What does this mean? Can I do this? And you can't just refer them to your T's and C's, because they're non-understandable. So then you have to expend a load of effort trying to explain to the customer what that part of the contract or the privacy policy means. Whereas if you'd just done the job right from the beginning, and you'd invested the time at the outset to clearly explain what it is that you do, you'd have less queries. Equally, you'd have less people breaking the rules. So if you say to someone in the T's and C's, you're not allowed to do that, then they're likelier to not read it or not engage or not understand it if it's really heavy language. And then can you even blame them or hold them liable, actually, from a legal aspect, if what you've written is so ununderstandable? Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Yes, absolutely. And how do you typically work with your clients? I suppose when you start at the beginning of a process, it's easier to make law just a seamless part of the brand and something you need to have there, but can also be stylized and making sure it's clear to the end consumer as well. Whereas it's harder when you come partway through. Have you found that with clients?
Yeah, I think lawyers are always an afterthought, even we are. it's not the first thing you want to spend your money on if you're a young organization. In fact, we used to work with really early stage startups, and all we were asked to do was T's and C's and privacy policies, but for compliance purposes mainly. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, if you look at it in marketing terms, law is an away purchase rather than a toward purchase. A toward purchase, and I'm quoting this from someone that spoke to me about it, I'm not an expert in this, but it's like, say, for example, you buy an iPhone, you buy it because it makes you feel good. So that's a toward purchase. But when you buy an insurance policy or legal services, it's an away purchase. So you buy it to take away pain. Okay. So it's a different psychology depending on what, on, you know, the product or the service that you're buying. So people need to be in pain, basically, before they contact lawyers. So they need to have had lots of situations that have been difficult to say, actually, I need to get this sorted now. And now I'm going to part with my money because I'm feeling the pain. People don't usually come to us because they love law. Although having said that, I think a cool set of T's and C's is something to be proud of. So yeah, it's always easier when you're involved at the beginning. We actually do, we also do training as part of our service to business teams. And we say, this is how to effectively engage with your legal counsel. And the first thing we say is engage them early. Don't come to them when the problem has already occurred. Because had you engaged them from the outset, you probably would have avoided that problem.
Do you have any advice for tech companies who are working directly with lawyers about how they can engage them? So I suppose you've just spoken about the time, like getting them engaged as early as possible, but is there anything that tech companies could do to have an easier time with their lawyers?
I mean, we work with some of the most amazing tech companies, and most of them are amazing in terms of how they treat their legal team. So they bring them in as part of their product teams. So when they're developing a new product, they will call their lawyers in from the outset now. So, the successful tech companies that we've worked with have that embedded in their culture. So a lawyer isn't just there to help you get rid of a problem. The lawyer is there as a growth enabler. So the lawyer is there to give you input in terms of your product. Say, for example, you're building a new feature on an app. That new feature needs to consider, there are lots of legal considerations with that new feature. So for example, data protection. Are you now going to collect more data? Are you going to start using data that you already have in a different way? If so, that means that that first screen that you're creating on that new feature needs to include a statement, a privacy statement. If you don't have your lawyer involved from the beginning, what you will do is you'll go away, you'll design your wireframes, you'll develop the app, and then you run it past the lawyer, and the lawyer will say, actually, you need to go and change this. You need to make sure that on the back end, someone's collecting that consent, for example. You need to make sure that if someone withdraws their consent, you can operationalize that in the back end. And now you need to go and rework everything. And by the way, your launch date is delayed for that reason. And then the lawyer gets blamed. Why are you blaming the lawyer? They're only doing their job. If you'd got them involved from the beginning, you wouldn't be in this problem now.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's this problem that companies see involving lawyers is going to extend the sales cycle, or the product cycle. But actually, if you involve them too late, then that extends the cycle. If you actually involve them earlier, you could shorten the cycle. So it's really great that you're saying that, to make sure they're really part of the team, because I completely agree. It's very important to do that. What's your favorite thing about being a founder?
I think my favorite, so when I was in jobs, I would get bored after about 18 months, if I'm honest. I just always wanted to run, and I felt like that wasn't an opportunity after the first sort of 12 to 18 months. And so being a founder, I find that I can go at my own pace, which is faster, and I can channel that energy into creating different things and improving. I haven't been bored for one second since I started this business. So that's my favorite thing about being a founder. You're never bored.
And do you now consider yourself more of an entrepreneur or a lawyer? And do you think there's a difference between the two terms?
Well, I think I'm definitely entrepreneurial. I've always wanted to start my own business, and I've always really, that's why I said initially when I was a law, when I studied law, it was really important that I was not private practice and I was actually in-house because I love business. So I've always wanted to be part of a business. I'm more of an entrepreneur than a lawyer. I have quite a high risk appetite, which lots of lawyers don't. Some lawyers do, but I'm a, yeah, I'm an entrepreneurial lawyer. That's a very lawyer response, isn't it?
One or the other. I don't think so. It depends on your perception of entrepreneurship, I suppose. And how, just as a question around the current situation as well, how have you been spending your time that you would normally be spending on commuting? I'm assuming you're maybe back in the office now.
I came back into the office a couple of weeks ago because I just couldn't stand working from home, because instead of commuting, I was working.
Yes.
And then you just continue to work, and then all of a sudden it's like 8 or 9 o'clock at night and you're like, what am I doing? Because you haven't got that break.
Yes.
It was just too much. I was burning out. And also there's nothing else to do. Mm-hmm. You couldn't go to the pub, which thank God now you can. But before the pubs opened on Saturday, I was like, oh my God, there's no outlet. There's no, I'm going to go to the theatre, or I'm going to go for a drink or for dinner. It was really tough, actually. Looking back, it was one of the toughest times of my life. But when you're in it, you don't really appreciate how tough it is to have all your normal options taken away from you.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. But I think it's also opened up a lot of different opportunities in the law space in terms of how things are changing and technology is being used more as well. And do you think that's going to continue now, that lawyers are going to embrace technology more and maybe start to use Slack, for example, and not go to the office so much and rely on paper documents?
Yeah, we'll see about that, I think. I think that humanity has a very short memory. And I don't think that COVID has gone on long enough to make a real cultural change. But that's what I think now. I'm hoping that you're absolutely right and that people start embracing better ways of working. Mm-hmm. But I think as soon as we go back into the office, my feeling is that people would just fall back into their normal lives. Maybe not immediately, but within, say, 6 months, they'll be back to normal.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll see. So would you have any advice for law students or lawyers who are wishing to go into legal tech or law and technology as a career?
I think that law and technology will become one in the same. Wherever you work now, technology is a huge part of it, and law will inevitably become that as well. I think if you want to go and work for a law tech company, then it depends on what technology you're talking about, what product that law tech company is selling, mm-hmm. and what capacity you want to be involved in. Because if you're developing legal products for that company, that's pretty cool. But you're not going to be practicing law as such. So just know that that's the case. I think what my when I was a student, I was really, I think, obviously that was a long time ago. So I finished my degree in 2007. And then I qualified as a lawyer in 2009. But basically the options were much more limited back then in terms of what you could do, or at least there wasn't that much awareness about what you could do. And I always felt a bit like an outsider, because I didn't want to do any of the traditional routes and I felt that I didn't have many options. But now there are so many options, and I think just reach out to people, and people are really happy to chat, especially in this new law world. Everyone's very open and very collaborative. So if you've got questions, or if you're looking at different routes that aren't your traditional route, then just reach out to people.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And do you have any books or courses that you've read or taken recently that you would recommend?
I've just read a book on design thinking that was written by a designer. I've forgotten the name, unfortunately, so that's not very helpful. But I think it was just called IDEO. It was from IDEO. Anyway, not sure. I'll send you the link. But it was really, really, really it was just great, because I thought, this has got nothing to do with legal design, this is just simple design thinking from a design studio, but all this stuff, all this thinking applies to law. So I think all lawyers should read it. But yeah, there's so many free courses out there. We did do a design thinking course actually again, from a design agency.
Yes, and I saw that you did a video on the Crafty Council as well. And when I tried to watch it, I had to pay, but now they're all free.
Yeah.
So you can watch them all now.
Yes. We did one with Crafty Council called Legal Ops on a Shoestring. And that's for in-house counsel, sole counsel that don't have huge budgets to buy loads of law tech, and how to make their ways of working more efficient without much money. So be sure to watch it.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on to the podcast and for talking to me today. It's been fantastic. And I hope our listeners have gone away knowing a bit more about legal design and design thinking in that way. And yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. That was fun.
You can find out more about Electra and what she's doing at the Law Boutique alongside the team by simply going to thelawboutique.co.uk. I'm Annabelle Pemberton, and you have just listened to the Wide Wig podcast, available on Spotify, iTunes, and Apple Podcasts. As always, if you liked what you just heard, be sure to follow this account on Spotify and follow The Wired Wig on Instagram for the latest tech law news and updates.